Ja, da ønsker jeg velkommen til NUGs månedlige medlemsmøte her i NUG Oslo. Vi har en del ting på programmet. Etter møtet så drar vi opp til Alexandros, en restaurant rett over gata, og får oss litt å bite i og litt å leske strupen med. Dere er alle sammen hjertelig velkommen dit. En ting som er verdt å merke seg når det gjelder NUG for tiden er at vi har nettopp annonsert at vi tar imot nominasjoner for fri programvareprisen som skal deles ut. Det er vel 12. oktober, mandag 12. oktober. Da kommer stifterne av Wikipedia for å dele ut prisen, og vi håper så mange som mulig har mulighet til å komme dit. Og det er veldig viktig at man får nominert alle de gode kandidatene som har drevet med fri programvare i Norge, så vi har et godt grunnlag å gi over til juryen, så de kan velge den. Den rette kandidaten. Nytt av året er at det blir også en kommunepris, og hvis noen har en kommune de har lyst til å nominere, så er det bare å sette i gang med det også. Vi skal jo ha en del møter fremover. Vi har ikke tema for resten av høsten, så hvis noen har forslag til tema, så bare ta kontakt. Og så blir jeg sendt rundt en navnelista som man kan føre seg på, så vi får oversikt over hvem som har vært her, og hvor mange som har vært her mest. Og så kan vi få de som ikke er på annonseringslisten til NUG ført opp, så dere får fremtidige annonseringer. De som er interessert i å lære mer om NUG kan lese informasjonsfolderen som ligger bort på hjørnet der. Når det er sagt, så er vi tilbake til dagens møte. Denne gangen har vi vært så heldige å få nestsjefen i Fribit, som har vært litt fremme i diskusjonene rundt opphavsrett, som jo er en debatt som pågår for fullt både i aviserne og andre plasser. Han har vært med på et prosjekt som de har kalt Genero, som tar sikte på å lage en forretningsmodell for copyleft-konseptet. Jeg er veldig spent på hva han har å fortelle. Vær så god, Øystein Jacobsen.
Jeg heter Øystein Jacobsen. Jeg har inntil nylig jobbet som forretningsutvikler i Telenor. Nå er jeg ansatt i Freecode som prosjektleder. Jeg er daglig leder for en interesseorganisasjon som heter Informed Individual, og jeg er nestleder i en interesseorganisasjon som heter Fribit. Jeg er selvfølgelig også medlem av EFN, ikke ennå av NUG. Teamet vil show. Vi i Fribit. Noen har lagt merke til oss. Vi har vært en del ute i media. Vi er en del politisk anlagt. Men vi hører liksom ikke hjemme i hverken leiren til Pirate Bay eller til IFPI. Vi er vel en slags midt imellom. Og vi har kommet opp med noe som heter Genero. Logoen er valgt, og vi kjenner kanskje den cirka igjen. Både som copyright og som share-alike. Det jeg skal snakke om i dag, det er jeg skal snakke litt om kontroversen rundt opphavsrett. Jeg skal snakke om de konvensjonelle distribusjonsmodellene som finnes rundt opphavsrettsbeskyttet materiale, og den vi foreslår i stedet for. Og så skal jeg snakke litt om rammevilkårene rundt økonomi, begrepet økonomi, sånn som den blir tatt imot i den digitale tidsalderen. Nå glemmer jeg meg egentlig litt for at jeg hadde lovt å snakke på engelsk. Because some of my friends will be watching this, and Genero is an international project, I will be holding this presentation in English. First off, I'm going to introduce what people know as copyright. Initially, there was no copyright. People in the Stone Age, they created something, and someone else could freely improve upon it and use it without restriction. Someone created a knife, someone else saw that, said, hey, good idea, and they made a fork. And so it went on. And strangely enough, they still created K-drawings without gaining exclusive rights to them. In 1709, the Statute of Anne was the first formal copyright regime implemented by the United States. It was a thorough copyright model, and the intent was to secure the rights of the writers, because publishing agents took over the whole business and bereft them of nothing. So copyright was introduced to transfer power back to the authors and the creators of the works. In the U.S. Constitution in 1790, there was a clause also introduced, probably inspired by the French Enlightenment, to have to secure the artist and the creator an exclusive rights to, in order to promote science and useful arts, as it was said. And it clearly states nothing about ownership, nothing about property, but it says incentive to promote. In 1889, the Berne Convention came along. Now, the US Constitution copyright system was such that you had to register in order to gain copyrights. And of thousands of works, only a few registered. The Berne Convention changed all that. Now, all of a sudden, everything became copyrighted. Absolutely everything. That was rather dramatic change. There was a lot of talk, but the U.S. went along with it. The recent years, you've seen, you may have heard all this, the Mickey Mouse Forever Act, increasing the length of copyright from original 14 years to now lifetime plus 70. That is a rather dramatic change. And in 1980, they introduced copyright on software by a technicality, through a technicality. And they also, they had laws passed, like in 1998, they had the Works for Hire Act passed in the United States, where a songwriter, when he published his work through a distribution mechanism, they acted like an employer, where he was a free agent, like a consultant, creating something for them. When they distributed it, the copyright was transferred to them. You also had the recent OCTA negotiations, horrible stuff, patents, etc. This is the copyright industry, and here's what they say. They say that home taping is killing music. They say piracy is killing music. They say piracy kills creativity. They've sued ever since the vinyl record, which enabled their very profitable business model. They have sued every new copying technology that has come along. Everything from the VHS player, cable television, the MP3 player, naturally. And it's always been the same argument. It is our rights, naturally, because they have a successful business model, and when something comes along that threatens that, a competing actor and competing channel, they just say, we do not give you permission to distribute our content. And content is not like any other, like commodities like salt or beans. It's not like people actually do care whether they listen to Madonna or some other. You can't just switch the same way you can do with one kind of salt from another kind of salt. This has led to a rise of something else called copyleft. Initially, sort of created in 1985 when Richard Stallman threw up the Free Software Foundation, but also the Open Source Initiative, the Creative Commons in 2001, Wikipedia in 2003, or the Wikimedia Foundation. And you've seen organizations popping up left and right. These are somewhat more thorough described in books. I've taken the liberty of displaying some that I like. I like free culture. I like gridlock economy. That's quite useful. You can also read The Pirate's Dilemma by Matt Mason. Awfully insightful book. And there are more. And actually, you have one particular organization called Fribit, which came along last year. We will be, what we're doing, initially what we came along was just Sven-Arne Draugli and a couple of other students said, we're tired of being called pirates, we're just guys, we're just regular people doing regular stuff. We don't want to be labeled criminals. The idea was to bring balance to the debate. Another argument than just the artist needs to get paid and the internet needs control and the lawlessness must stop and all that, to try to problematize the simple arguments. We, after very much debate, we came, it is not a question of copyrights, it is not a question of copyleft or patents or such. It's a question of what kind of society we want to live in. And to that end, we say that our purpose is to maximize public access to knowledge and culture, which is the original intent of copyright. We just believe it is somewhat off course, but not at the expense of other principles that society is concerned with, such as privacy, due process of law, non-censorship, and free communications. Ideas which many would see find obvious, but they seem to drown in the artist has a right and all that stuff. So conventional distribution models are based on a hub and a spoke principle. The logic is at the center. The distributor is not just a distributor, he's also an aggregator. He performs all the functions. It is a vertically integrated business model where all the functions are layered on top of each other. To make an example, if you have Tina Meirier making milk, they would own the farm, the trucks, the production facilities, and the retail outlets. And they would control not only who would get to sell their milk, but what the milk was used for. And if the milk was used in some fancy dish at a restaurant, they would charge a higher royalty, and the chef would have to ask for permission first. We would not accept that, but we do with copyright. But this vertically integrated business model, frowned upon in all other aspects of society, is deeply embedded. The four large ones are particularly good at this, but they also go, like I said previously, they assume the copyright itself, but they also have channels. Spotify, for instance, is also owned. They gave away shares of Spotify to the recording industry, just so that the industry would be more lenient with the royalties. But you have others. Even innovative Apple controls not just the distribution channel, but the mechanism, but the endpoints. You have to have an iTunes account to use your Apple and only, etc. You know that stuff. The Norwegian Consumer Council has said that, well, you can't do this stuff, but well, they do it anyway. But also new ones. Every single company that does business say, well, we're doing this, we want to be able to do more, we want a larger piece of the value chain. Nokia does this by saying, we have the handsets, now we're going to distribute content. Telenor says, we have the customers, we have the networks, now we want to distribute content. Typically this is fine until the point where you get some sort of preferential treatment, like internet access. If the internet access is provided by a company that also provided telephone access, especially true with AT&T and in Germany, all of a sudden you find that you can't use IP telephony over your mobile internet service, because it would be, you know, probably it's because it's in competition with their conventional mobile telephony service. And generally, we as a society, we frown upon this preferential treatment. The main problem, like I said, is the reduced competition, the bilateral agreements saying that we won't sue you if you don't sue us, the common interest group like the Motion Picture Association and such. But also, it's simply inefficient. The cost of going around asking permission, if you want to make a documentary and you need to ask permission for every minute in this movie, it's costly. I heard an example of Anna Kaur wanting to make a documentary, and they had to hire a lawyer for full time for a month just to acquire permissions for old movie clips. And also, more and more consumers are getting upset with how they're being treated. They get upset, rightfully in my opinion, by lawsuits such as DME Thomas and Tenenbaum and Ms. Krieger and so forth. And that, you see, if this leaves room for something new, something other, something else. And what we've done, we've made a needs analysis. Genero is not an idea as such. It's a result of analysis. What are the needs of a creator? Well, first of all, he needs a reason to get out of bed. And for a software developer, that's usually what we call needs fulfillment. He has a need. He needs a logistics system, so he builds a logistics system. And no, he don't care if he shares it with anyone else. That's why he didn't create it. Well, that's not why he created it in the first place. If someone else improves upon it, that's good for him. Recognition, of course. People want to get famous and get laid. But in a cultural context, it's all often because people have a need to express something. They want to say something, and they do so. For instance, with my presentation, it's... now that I think of it, I didn't put a Creative Commons stamp on it, so it's copyrighted. Not for long, though. But it also needs money, right? Some do it because they want to make money. But when it comes to money, there are many revenue streams, many business models. They're typically divided in two, direct revenue and indirect revenue. Direct revenue being where you get money, a transactional thing. I have money, you have something I want, and we trade, we swap. This only works if this is in limited supply. If this can be copied once I've given it, I can only sell it once, strictly speaking. Like the creator of the this self-replicating machine thing, he says that it wouldn't be a... He created it using open hardware principles. He said there was no point in creating a self-replicating machine and charging for the machine because you can only sell it once. But once he decides to get out of bed, and he also needs other things. He needs access to infrastructure, tools, funding, all kinds of assistance. You know, people have a driving need to say something. And what we're finding is that with reduced cost of production, I mean, what you previously needed, a $100,000 video camera to do, you can now do with the same quality in a digital camera for $1,000, a high resolution sensor with a high resolution, high size sensor, and professional sound recording equipment in your home. So this creates the long tail. I'll get back to the business models later. But once you've created something, you need to distribute it. And your needs when it comes to mass distribution, publishing, not limited distribution as in I want to send something to my friends or a secret encrypted message with military intelligence, but if I want to publish it, there are two needs. I need to connect supply and demand, and I need to generate demand. And traditionally, with broadcast, the idea has been to create demand where there is none. Everyone has to see the Cosby Show because there's nothing else on. So, well, I didn't want to see it in the first place. I never heard of the Cosby Show, but all right, I'll see it. So everyone saw Cosby Show. Now, the story is different. YouTube and such has changed demand. We're no longer focusing on the creating demand. We're focused on finding what is relevant to us. The audience, I have chosen not to call them a consumer because a consumer is someone who passively consumes. That day and age is gone. He's a discerning customer. He wants availability, low price, etc. So all this analysis and more, I'll show you later. Actually, I can show you one now. We did a survey. You won't be seeing this on the TV. You won't be seeing it here either. But if you go to a URL called tgtangogolf.freebit.no, you will see it, and you can participate in the survey. We ask whether people file share. If they do, what are they file sharing? And why? And ask them whether it is important, unimportant, a little important, or really important that the material is instantly available, all available in one place, one-stop shopping, no advertising, no menus, free content, high quality, etc. We also asked, is there something you lack? We asked, is your access to cultural goods greater or lower than after internet and file sharing became commonplace? It may seem like a silly question, but remember, this is the ultimate objective of copyrights, to maximize public access to cultural goods. Whether or not you're spending more or less money now that you have access to file sharing. And we also ask about what political parties you feel is aligned with your interests. The results are quite interesting, actually. 95% out of 1,000 respondents said, yes, we're file sharing. We also asked, if you're not file sharing, why? I don't bother. All kinds of questions, because mom said I couldn't. I don't know how, I don't have room. Another, one guy said he's not file sharing, he's just waiting until a friend of his downloaded, so he's copying from him. He didn't realize that file sharing is, you know, just sharing information regardless of technology. What are you file sharing? Pretty much everything, except for books and user-generated content. When you look at whether it is important or not, you see that 80% has replied it is very important that it is instantly available. And also 75% without DRM, high quality, etc. The fact that the content is free is at like eighth place. And I believe it. So here are a lot of qualities by file sharing that they feel that they're not getting somewhere else. And the copyright industry, they can say, well, we have iTunes, we have Spotify. They're just two channels. They can't possibly cover all the needs of all the users in the entire world. You need thousands of channels. I mean, how many torrent sites are there? How many sharing technologies are there? Literally hundreds of different kinds of technology. So this, again, shows there's a market potential. We also talked about the lacks and et cetera. This is currently unavailable, publicly available, because of the survey provider is doesn't provide that functionality. We will, however, make it available. Right. So we used all this information, that and more, to create some guidelines. What would a perfect system be like? Well, first of all, no exclusive rights. It has to be non-exclusive. Otherwise, you would have to gain permission every time you need to use something. So in this system, permission has to be assumed. It is has to be trust-based because law has turned out to be ill-equipped to govern everyone with all kinds of use. Law is intended, the courtroom is not intended for suing 40,000 people at once. So we need to have trust mechanisms instead. Pretty much like open source does. It does not. Open source software is not governed by law, but by norm. It has to be distributed, like the internet. It can't have one central point. The internet does, however, have one point, the ICANN, but it is non-profit. It is. There is some slight controversy, but it's worked so far. It has to be content independent, not focusing on one thing, but on all things. And it has to be API-based. The reason for this, that it has to be API-based, is because if you go in, there's a book, Innovation Happens Elsewhere, saying, and believe, no matter how smart you are, no matter how large your organization, there's always going to be someone out there that's smarter, that understands his customers better than you. So if we focus on creating the basic service, someone else can create the channels, the interfaces. And that's how Twitter and the very internet that we know works, because it is an end-to-end principle where the logic is not at the center, it's at the ends. So here's what we've come up with so far. It is a registry, like a DNS. It's a distributed federated registry, where an artist would put in his work, just metadata, not the work itself, but a reference to it. And it says, here's my stuff, this is me, and this is what I want for it, this much money, under these terms. This kind of money for that term and this. All right. So any distributor can access this content and publish it and distribute it as long as he adheres to the business terms stipulated by the creator. The distributor, he would have no risk. He would just, you know, fetch whatever content fits his profile, the kind of market he wants to address. Some would, you know, do a raw dump, take everything. Some would focus on Norwegian goth music. Some would focus on a mix between, let's say, ethical stuff, only showing, distributing movies about, you know, documentaries or stuff. So the distributor would do his thing. His benefit, he can't go beyond. He has to be horizontal. He's horizontally locked. He can't go down in the value chain or up in the value chain, although he's at the top. But in return, he doesn't have to ask for permission. He can do what he's best at, which is distributing, being in touch with his customer. On the other end, you have an aggregator, like a domain registrar. Because the registry wouldn't have resources to create the best channels of making itself available, someone else could do that. So Telenor could decide that our message would be, come to us, dear book writer. We'll facilitate everything for you. We'll fund you. We'll do whatever. It doesn't matter who you go to. You would still, your content would be still be available to the same internet of stuff, no matter where you went. So there would be competition. Unlike a vertically integrated business model, if you go to Sony and sign a deal with Sony, you have to take the deal. And you would get access to Sony's channels. If you register it with Gennaro, Sony could push it as well. iTunes could push it as well. Anyone could push it. They all get the same treatment. So I've set up a use case. Here is some actors. A public library would host a registry because they're content independent, they're neutral, and their purpose is to promote science and knowledge. So here's a guy, John. He has a book, and his license, his business term says, digital copies are free. A hard copy, I need $5. And anyone can sell that and charge $1 million if they choose to, but competition would probably press the price down to a reasonable margin. The file transfer, how it works, I've taken the liberty of adding some technical details. The most efficient way of transferring files, many to many, is through torrents. So the registry for each work, or each component of each work, would be a torrent file. The distributor would download the torrent file and get it seeded through him through the aggregator, and he would have to be a seed for as long as he distributed the content itself. We also have the Gennaro license. The Gennaro license is a cornerstone of the Gennaro project. Basically, initially, you have saying that we say that Gennaro is filled with any free work, free as in speech, not as in beer. The term is that anyone has to be able to do whatever they want to for non-commercial purposes with it. So, for instance, the Creative Commons non-derivative license would not be accepted, but any other Apache or GPL or Creative Commons licensed work would do. So the Gennaro license is, so the registry aggregates and enables through one channel all the stuff that is already free. You could do that without money at all. And I can take anything that is in the SourceForge library, pull it out, and distribute it for non-commercial purposes, or even commercial purposes, probably. Most licenses allow me to do that. That would be a good thing to begin with. But if you also add, saying that if you have a free work, and within this Gennaro system, I say, this is the money I want. That's a potential to make money. That's all of a sudden you add a business model. You say that, if here's my song, I'm not going to sue a regular person for listening to it. So I'm going to staple it with a Creative Commons license. But for non-commercial purposes, if you are a business and you want to sell it, or if you are making a movie and you want to sell it, or somehow make money off of it, you have to pay me. But the derivative work, if you notice the parts where I've outlined with red here, when you create a derivative work based on someone else's work, you need to attribute the parent work. Common attribution guidelines say the by tag of the Creative Commons license says you have to attribute according to the medium, saying, well, if there's a rolling title at the end of a movie, you have to say, well, music by. But what we mean by attribution is it also you provide a link saying, I like a Google link, making the other work more relevant. I used a portion of this song in my new movie. And if I make money off of this movie, I'm going to give you 5%. It's a revenue share. But it's not like current. Like I met with a bunch of documentary creators in a panel debate, and their greatest concern was that they didn't have much money to begin with. And if they wanted to make a documentary about the Olympics and they added 1 minute worth of footage from Ole Klemetsen fight or something, they would have to pay half of the budget just for that 1 minute up front for a limited right to use. So they couldn't do whatever they wanted with it even. And they had all these, it was a legal nightmare. Not to mention the risk. They could be forking out a ton of money without getting any in return. Here, if they use a minute from something, they're free to do so. If they make money, only then only then would they be paying. And they would be paying a fair share. So the De Niro initiative is in parallel. De Niro initiative would be somewhat like the W3C, defining the shape of the registry, the rules, maintaining the general license if that needs to be updated, much like the Creative Commons, but also guidelines. What is a fair attribution? Without having any police authority, mind you, just saying what is fair, assuming that people will adhere to it. And provide support functions like legal and payment. I'll show you an example of payment, how that works. Here's a registry where someone puts a bunch of metadata and links to the torrent files, which are links to the original work. And a monetization distribution at the top, where I say I get 75%, the aggregator gets 10%, and the Peter Sellers, et cetera, has. So that's the, if someone else creates a new work based on my work, that would be at the top there. The business terms here says that I have a revenue share with the distributor. Whoever wants to distribute my stuff, they can keep 30% of whatever money they make. You make zero, you get zero. You make $100, you get to keep 30. So the more you manage to squeeze out of your customers, the better. Is this really interesting? Maybe, somewhat. A registry would approve on who would be aggregators and distributors. This is a potential censoring mechanism, but we'll have to agree because you can't allow distributors who doesn't pay. They need to follow the rules. And a content owner would choose a license. If he chooses the De Niro license, it is a CC plus license, meaning it uses the Creative Commons license as a framework, and adding a for non-commercial purposes, and adding a business terms for commercial purposes. The content owner would choose an aggregator and register this work. The distributor would figure out stuff he wants to sell, fetches a copy, and push it to the user. Now, once he fetched money, he needs to pay the aggregator. But one of the problems here, that it doesn't have to be one aggregator. Let's say there are hundreds. This is where the concept of micropayments come in, where he gets 10 kroner for work, that guy passes on 1 kroner, and that guy passes off 10% of that. And payments has a surcharge every time you make a transaction. So instead of bouncing like that, you have a De Niro payment provider. Not so fortunate abbreviation in Norwegian, but there you are. So the distributor sends off $10, the payment provider checks the registry, figures out who gets what, and then ships out the money. The money goes to the aggregators, would be the agents, and they'd pass it on to their users. There doesn't have to be a per instance thing. It could be a weekly or daily update, reducing the amount of payments being made. One example of a distributor who's taken a step into the new world is Steam. I don't know if any of you have seen it. They focus on the user experience, where I just shop. I purchase a license which I feel is perpetual, although it's a conventional copyright, I have no rights thing. But the user experience is that of, it is mine. Because I threw away my account a long time ago and then I bought new games. And then all of a sudden I saw all of my old games were still there. And it's just easier and more accessible than if I were to pirate it. So I asked myself, why on earth would I bother to pirate it when I can just buy it? See, that's the problem right now. Piracy has not only been free, but it has all the other benefits that copyright is a hindrance to creating a good user experience. Steam, being that they controlled, they had the content themselves and they wanted to be a new distributor. They just told their old distributors to shove it, basically. And notice also here, the one extra copy on Half-Life 2, it says that I already owned Half-Life 2. When I bought a pack, the orange box, I got another license. It wasn't wasted. I now have two licenses. I can choose to give one away. Again, giving me the feeling, it's a promotional thing, but it gives me the feeling that it is my stuff and I own it forever. And they also created an ecosystem where much of they're making it easier for third parties to come in and innovate on their platforms. Counter-Strike is, or was, the world's most played game, and that was a modification made on spare time by a guy who just wanted to kill terrorists or other cops, one of them. So the pirates, they have all these modifications, and they're really good. So they really understand the value of creating a useful ecosystem. So I'm going to talk a little about the economy of abundance. Have any of you heard of the long tail, the concept, hence? Pretty much all of you. The long tail is, here you have 1 million different units of something. In this case, let's just say music, 100 million songs. And some of those songs will be sold more than others. Madonna and Michael Jackson, etc., will be sold more than some weird techno Norwegian thing. A store typically has limited shelf space. That's what it says. There are limits to how much he can fit in a store, and the shelf has a cost, both in rent and dusting it and fixing it and repairing it after fire. So there's a cost attached to having something in store. So you only bother to sell the most popular stuff, or if you want to be a niche, then you sell something off sides. But traditionally, they only sell the famous stuff. So when it comes to the online experience, the cost of distribution has fallen not to low cost, but zero. It is now zero cost to distribute something. It is too small to meter. That's what it says. Moore's Law made sure of that. Not only did processing power double every 18 months, but the price halved. The price of distribution and the price of production has dropped dramatically. So now the tail, instead of just the head, now produces or accounts for, in many cases, the bulk of the profits. They're less choosy. They're not in such a good bargaining position as Madonna or Michael Jackson. So you can still sell it at the same price. That's the long tail. The economy of free. A new book now by the same Wired author, by Chris Anderson. And he says, he talks about how you can make money off of something that is free. It is surprisingly easy. You don't charge for the content itself. It has been commoditized meaning, why would I bother paying for a web server when I can just use Apache? The other web server needs to provide something more. So the basic functions has been commoditized, and someone needs to provide for something else. I'll give you an example. This guy, Kevin Kelly, talks about better than free, and he speaks of... No, that's not him. I don't bother finding it. Chris Anderson mentions something he called freemium as a business model. Freemium means that the basic service is for free, then you pay for extra functionality or extra stuff. Like the online survey I discovered charged me 200 kroner a month once I got a certain number of respondents. But this economy is different from regular economy with physical stuff, because the economy of scarcity, basically the word economy itself talks about how a society distributes limited goods when something is limited. The reason there's no price on air, although air obviously has value, is simply because there's so much of it. If there was very little air, I guarantee you, like in Hong Kong, they actually sell air by the bottles and little booths. So again, but that's because they don't have an abundance of air, of clean air. But what you can do is not to sell air or water, which we obviously have plenty of, but sell access to it. So when I go to the store and I pick up a bottle of water, I'm not paying for the water. I can get water anywhere. I pay to get cold water, or water right now, the immediacy aspect. Like, for instance, the business model of movies is such that even though Max Manus was the most pirated movie in Norway ever, it was also the one that was the most, had the grossing revenues in Norwegian movies, right, next after Titanic. Simply because people wanted to see it right away. Yes, they could get it sometime in a good quality, but they wanted to see it right here, right now. They wanted the movie experience and the social aspect of it. So they're not paying for the content itself. They're paying for access to it. Same with music services like Pandora that learned what kind of music you liked and proposed music, not just based on what people like you also liked, but based on how the music was shaped. And when I used it, I found music that was really old and really cool. When I searched for Rage Against the Machine, eventually I would not get Rage Against the Machine hits, but I would get similar that were really, really cool. That service was, of course, canceled like anyone else. And Spotify is just a paleness in comparison, because simply our media consumption is now different. There's only so many movies or songs that you know about that you want to search, which is my belief that TV series has become so popular recently, because when it comes to movies, you have to know about all the, you can't just, we've become discerning. So we don't just watch anything. We just don't watch something on TV just because it's there. We pick. And once we've figured out a good TV series that has five seasons of 22 episodes per season, that's 100 episodes. So you don't have to look so much. You have to look once every 100 episodes instead of once every movie. To create these business models, you can't be one person or one company that understands how best to figure out market need. The market needs vary. That is why you need to, the creators need to step back and let distributors do their thing. They need to have someone else be able to use their content, like, which was different, and he hit a market that the original writer did not, because he had a song. I actually think that I'm going to stop. That was basically the presentation of the Dinero project that we hope will marginalize copyright simply by being better, because we have not given up on law or democracy, but there are so many international treaties standing in the way. that we don't think it'll happen anytime soon. This is simply a quicker and better way of doing it. That was it. Any questions? Yes.
The obvious question, what's actually working at this point in time?
What's actually working? Nothing. We have a server. We have basic APIs up and running. We don't have the torrent. If anyone you know how to set up a torrent tracker, would like to do that. So we have the registry, we have the data model, which is actually based on the compatible with the libraries Dublin Convention.
How many developers are working in Genero now?
3 or 4. All of them being annoyingly concerned with news and spending their time with talking to musicians who won't listen, who'll never understand anyways, instead of just coding. I want them to code.
Do they get paid, or do they do it full-time or part-time? Or?
No, we pay to do it.
Well, it's an interesting talk, but just a couple of questions. Do you have any competitors around here? There must be many people. You cited the book by the author of The Long Tail, right, Anderson? So, are there other competing projects?
I've looked around. There is one distributor, Magnitude Records, by a fellow named John Buckman, who has a keen understanding of. Or I wouldn't say comparable to mine, but he doesn't have such a project running. He has a distributed mechanism, but not. We're just enablers. No one is doing this, as far as we know. We've spoken with both Matt Mason of the author of The Pirate's Dilemma, John Perry Barlow of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and a bunch of others. I haven't heard of anything. However, Phoebit's purpose is to maximize public access to knowledge and culture, and to identify the mechanisms which will do this to its greatest extent, and work to realize non-existing mechanisms. If we find another project that does this better or more advanced, that we feel have the right angle to things, we will naturally support them any way we can. Our hope is actually that the Norwegian Library, the National Library, will assume control of the project.
So I understand that the basic idea is to actually distribute money. That's your key point.
The first part is to make free works more accessible by making a standard way of finding and accessing free works. The second one is to add a business model saying that if you are a creator of a free work and someone else makes money off of it, you get a cut. So it's two-part, the availability thing and the monetization thing.
And regarding money, this is based on trust, I guess.
Not when it comes to commercial players. Well, not when it comes to distributors. They have to follow the rules. If they don't, they can be sued like anyone else. I don't see a problem suing large companies. I do see a problem suing regular people, people suing people. I do not see a problem with suing large companies who distribute. Like, if iTunes were to help themselves to the database, selling items for $1 a unit and not paying any money to the original creator, that would be a lawsuit. We also do have trust mechanisms that we hope will make the need of law less prevalent. I don't know if any of you have heard of this. Informed individual. It's a trust system that basically you as an individual chooses who you want to trust. I want to trust the World Wildlife Foundation, the Genero Project, and my neighbor. And those trust others again, and they trust others again, and so you get a web of trust. And their opinions will be made available to you. So if I, as an individual, chooses to trust the Genero Initiative, and we see a distributor who doesn't follow the rules, we can tag that guy as being a moron. And when he then goes onto a web page, his informed individual plugin will tell him you're now at a site which is going to take your money and not give anything to the author. But this system can be used, it was originally intended for use with ethical purchases. So when I scan a product, I can see whether, like now, I know that Coca-Cola, Bonacqua is the same as Coca-Cola, which is bad, in my personal opinion. This system will make that easier. It is also intended for use with a generic system to make trust and norm replace that of law, because law is simply inefficient and it's egalitarian. Or non-egalitarian, strictly. Yes? Anyone else? No? Well,
you did touch on one thing I found interesting. You said that air obviously have value, and that touches on the topic of what's actually determining things' value. One view of that is that thing doesn't have value in itself. It's given value, for example, by the law.
What didn't have value?
Things may not have value in itself. They might be given value by the law. What is the value of the word hello? If it's impossible to have control over the word, it doesn't have a value. If the law gives someone monopoly on using the word, it obviously has value. So the law in itself can actually assign value to things that doesn't have value from nature.
No, well, let's the book, The Gridlock Economy, debates the concept of ownership. Pulls up an example in Russia after the fall of the wall. They didn't have property pricing. They didn't have prices on property. The consequence of that was that people who lived on the farm lived in the cities, and those living in the city will live on the farm because pricing didn't drive them to their respective neighborhoods. It worked much better after that. How you determine value, I know, for instance, the price of diamonds is inflated by De Beers Corporation because there's plenty of diamonds out there, but because they control all the natural deposits, they can just not distribute it, thus driving the value up. And the only reason diamond is valuable instead of quartz is because of the availability of, I mean, there are more quartz in the world there than there are diamonds. I think that would be a... It is not a question I'm equipped to answer in a true sense. I would have to write a paper on it, or read a paper.
The point I try to make is that copyright maybe have value because it is protected by the law. If it wasn't protected by the law, it wouldn't have value. Would a beat, like any 3-4 beat, if that had copyright, it would have a value?
At the moment, you can't actually. It has value now.
You can't copyright a beat.
No. But beat has value. Lawrence Lessig, in his book Free Culture, problematizes this. That he says that if there is value, then there is a right. If this music has value to someone else, then I have a right to it. If it has no value, that is a problem.
But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's... Because there is a right, it has a value. If it didn't have a right,
no value. Well, I disagree with that. For instance, I argued in front of FRP, trying to say that, all right, let's say you have two pieces of software. One is proprietary and the other one is free. But they're otherwise identical. Clearly identical. Wouldn't, for society, the free software have more value than the proprietary ones? Because the proprietary ones, it has value because I can use it. The free one has a greater value because, not only because the price is lower, but because it allows me to do whatever I want with it. So the value for society is higher. I don't think value has something to do with protection by the law. I think value is whether or not we find use in it, whether it improves our lives.
I think you two are discussing two different concepts. The one is the concept of value, and the other one is the concept of price or economic value.
No.
So value doesn't have to be just economic value. It can also be value for people or value for society, etc. So that's one distinction. And the other point is also that copyright is based on scarcity. And it actually creates scarcity now that scarcity is not necessary anymore. And the scarcity can, in the short run, drive the price up. But in the long run, it will just create poorer accessibility. And then the value will go down, and people will go elsewhere.
It has been pointed out by a radio reporter that no matter copyright, one effect of copyright, the way it is today, the length, the vanity, the time of protection being so long, says that copyright works are like fresh meat. Once they've been playing, they're available for 5 years, then they're unavailable anymore. You won't find it in any stores. And by doing it that way, they make sure that people always have to buy new stuff. But eventually, things are going to fall out of copyright. And a lot of people are creating stuff with copyleft licenses. So that abundance of free stuff will eventually tip over and crush that which is owned. So, and that is what we're seeing with software now. Free software is commoditizing proprietary software, driving them out of business. Or not driving them out of business, but forcing them to change their business model. That's why Nokia is buying Symbian and give it away to the Symbian Foundation, simply because they have to. Android has come along and commoditized the software industry, so the mobile software industry. So eventually it's going to be impossible to charge money for basic operating systems on mobile phones, and so forth and so forth. So that is what we're trying to do with the Genera project, to make free software or free stuff more available and better, competing out proprietary software, so that we don't have to do this whole reform thing. Copyright can just, you know, people adhering to the copyright regime can just, you know, not make money and insist on their rights and theft and property and use all those words. And those who copyleft can just create and be more efficient and better and win. Yes.
I noticed you talked a lot about creative works being a part of this ecosystem you're proposing here, working on. How about non-creative works, like introductory books on mathematics, for example, which is pretty established stuff?
Well, creative works, by that I mean things that can be copyrighted.
There's a copyright on non-creative works too, right? Like a school book.
Yes, it has copyright.
Yes, it has copyright.
So that's what I mean by when I say creative works. It's okay, something that has a copyright. The reason because I'm using that because John Perry Barlow insisted that if anyone used the word content around him, he would, you know, go up in flames. He didn't like that word. So I try to avoid using the word content whenever I can. That's why I say creative works. No. But I like him. I respect him. But we've actually talked about data streams, providing links to data streams, not like weather forecasts. We've also taken into account on how to facilitate open source movies, constant changing works. That is much more complicated than that of static works. And also to make available all the raw material, all the crap that is out there. I mean, if you made available, like you said, school books, brochures, 50-year-old car manuals. Someone will find a use for it. You've probably seen this. I ask myself whether or not I would show it. Have any of you seen the Through You guy making mashups based on dozens of YouTube videos, creating something entirely new based on something that is already there? Fantastic music. I call that creative. And this one, I don't know if you've seen this. This is the fairy tale Ravanka, as told by Pakistani. So to me, these are obviously creative, even though they're created by garbage, junk left out there by someone. And that's what I want to do. One of the things I want to do with the Genera project, so that if you have a ton of junk, it's worth the effort to make it available. Because if someone uses it, they may give you a cut if they make money. So there's a potential for revenue that, you know, why not?
I think you have to cut it there because we are running out of tape, I think.
All right.
So thank you very much, and please accept this token of appreciation.
Thank you.
It's a beer, the Noog beer.
I'd rather have a beer.
We'll go there.
Thank you.